Well, thank you very much. It's great to be back. I see this little clock here tells me that I've got 14 minutes and 42 seconds. Well, I hope you guys don't mind if I take a little more time than that. There's a lot to talk about. And first of all, let me acknowledge what a great opportunity this is to meet and greet with folks from all over the country who are so responsible for the extraordinary success of American agriculture. And let me also say how thrilled I am that the groups, the corn, wheat, sorghum, and soybean groups, have gotten together with other ag groups to form the U.S. Farmer and Rancher Alliance. I think that's an extraordinary opportunity for all of agriculture to come together to promote a single message about agriculture and to do a better job than we've done in the past of educating the rest of the 99% of the population that are not involved in farming how significant you are to their lives and how much of a benefit they have as a result of the work that's done on our farms and our ranches and producers and growers all across the United States. What a story to tell, a story that involves not only making sure that this country is food secure. You know, we sometimes take that for granted in this country. You know, we only have to pick up the paper today to look at what kind of strife occurs in countries that are not food secure, not capable of producing their own food, because of the tremendous work of our farmers, ranchers, and growers, people in the United States don't have to worry about whether there's enough to eat. What a remarkable story that in and of itself would be. When you add to that the fact that American consumers spend less for their groceries than virtually anybody else in the world, a recent study that we did at USDA suggested that just 6 to 7% of our paychecks go to the grocery store. When we walk out of that grocery store, we have so much more in our pockets from our paychecks as a result of the work of farmers and ranchers and growers. And I ask my urban and suburban friends who are not as fully aware of what farmers do for them, what they do with that extra cash. You know, if you in any other developed country, you'd be spending 20 to 25% of that paycheck, and in a developed country, it might be as high as 50%. And so it's a fair question to ask folks across the country, what do you do with that extra cash that you have as a result of the extraordinary productivity of American farmers? Do you buy a nicer car? Do you live in a bigger home? Do you take a vacation? Do you have an opportunity to spend a little money to put aside for college education for your children or maybe even encourage a larger retirement nest egg? And when was the last time you thanked a farmer and rancher for that opportunity? What a tremendous story to tell in terms of the impact that agriculture has on the economy. One out of every 12 jobs in this country is connected in some way, shape, or form to what happens on the farm. And without what's happening on the farms and ranches of this country, we wouldn't have that kind of employment opportunity. What a story to tell in trade. So much of the American economy is based on trade deficits and conversations about how to reverse that. But in agriculture, we have a trade surplus, and I'll be talking about that in more detail in just a few minutes. So it is a great story to tell, and it's a good story to tell this year. USDA has taken a look at 2011 and has decided that this is going to be a good year overall for farm country. We see net farm income increasing to $94.7 billion. That's a 20% increase over last year, and last year was a 34% increase over the year before. It'll be the second highest income level as adjusted for inflation in the last three decades. That's certainly good news. Crop receipts up 14%, $24.1 billion, led by corn, cotton, soybeans, and wheat. Livestock receipts also edging up a bit as well. Just in the last 2 years, as a result of the extraordinary efforts of the folks in this room and folks like you across the country, we've been able to rebuild equity in the farm economy. We now see real value of farm assets exceeding $2 trillion. We've basically recouped all of that which we lost in 2009, and that's certainly a good story. Certainly a good time for us to consider the possibility of purchasing equipment that we might have put off during tough times. As a result of the passage of the tax bill in December, I want to remind everybody that this year you have a 100% business expensing opportunity that you may not always have. So if you want to buy a tractor, a combine, or planter, you get to expense the entire amount all in a single year. It might be something you want to talk to your tax folks about, a fairly significant benefit. And when you do that, you're obviously going to help put Americans back to work making those implements. So would encourage you to take a look at that. Great year, great message in exports. We anticipate and project $135.5 billion of ag exports. This is up $20 billion over 2010. It will be a record year, as 2010 was a record year. It will provide us with a trade surplus of $47.5 billion. For every $1 billion of ag trade, there are 8,000 people working in this country in jobs associated with agriculture and trade. So if we do $135.5 billion, that means over 1 million people will be employed that might not otherwise be employed but for agricultural trade. And we're focused on a trade strategy that's going to continue to increase trade opportunities. We understand the significance and importance of trade and exports. First of all, let me say to you and to my good friend Congressman Chairman Lucas, we are very interested in making sure that the free trade agreements that he discussed are approved by Congress. I would anticipate in the very, very near future, within the next several weeks, Congress will be presented with the Korean Free Trade Agreement. Our hope is that it gets enacted and pushed into law before July 1. You all know what that will mean to agriculture. 60% of a multi-billion-dollar trade opportunity in Korea, 60% of the items that we currently trade to Korea are corn, soybeans for crush, cotton, cherries, orange juice, grape juice, whey, all of those products and others will be duty-free. The other 40% of that which we trade will have their tariffs and duties reduced over a period of time. A tremendous opportunity for us to grow our export opportunities within Korea. And this is part of an overall strategy, so that you know this just doesn't happen in the abstract. We at USDA have taken the last 2 years at focusing on a strategy for increasing trade. We have looked at every single country we do business with. We have put them on a continuum, a trade continuum. We've identified them as a fragile market, as a closed market, as an emerging market, as a mature market, and we've developed specific strategies for each individual country, knowing that that's the best way to expand opportunity. We have focused on reducing barriers, and that's why I was so pleased yesterday when President Obama and President Calderon met to finally suggest that we have finally reached a consensus and agreement on the Mexican truck issue. That's going to be a great opportunity for us to remove the tariffs that Mexico has assessed against our 99 agricultural products. It's going to open up more trade opportunities for us in Mexico. That truck agreement basically calls for certain safety standards in Mexican trucks coming into the United States, certain requirements of the drivers of those trucks that they have safe driving records, that they know our language, that they understand our traffic rules and will abide by them, that they have a good safety, documented safety record. In exchange, when the agreement is inked shortly, 50% of the tariffs will be removed immediately. The other 50% will be removed when the first set of trucks are certified by our Department of Transportation and the Mexican Department of Transportation. Obviously, very, very good news in terms of trade opportunities. We're going to continue to focus on countries where there are increasing middle classes, and China is probably the best example. It's one of the reasons I think that we now can say, without any question, that China is our number one customer. They surpassed Canada in 2010, so now it's China, Canada, and Mexico. We'll continue to focus on countries that have emerging middle classes. It's one of the reasons why I'll be traveling to Indonesia and to Vietnam later this spring in an effort to continue to promote agricultural opportunities, American agricultural opportunities. We're going to continue to fund trade shows. We're going to continue to try to bring foreign buyers to the United States, all designed to encourage expansion of exports. We're going to make sure that we also encourage some of our friends to reduce the sanitary and phytosanitary barriers that they sometimes construct to make it more difficult for us to bring product into their countries. One example, recently we're in the process of negotiating with Mexico to reduce the barriers that they've created in terms of potato transactions and opportunities. Again, another opportunity for us to expand trade. So I think you're going to continue to see a robust effort in trade. We know that that increases the bottom line for farmers and ranchers and growers, and we also know that it creates jobs. But it's not just the foreign markets. It's also the domestic markets that we need to look at and expand. That's one of the reasons why we've put a substantial amount of effort on bio-based products and the labeling of bio-based products. We think the American public is anxious to purchase products grown and raised and produced in America, and we know if we can put the bio-based label on products that will encourage consumers to purchase those. We now have identified roughly 5,000 products that are bio-based, and we will be labeling them so that as folks go in to stores across the country, they'll know which products will be able to help their local farmers. That obviously also involves a continued commitment to biofuels and to bioenergy. And I'm here today to suggest that those who seek to slow this process down, those who seek to stop this emerging opportunity for the country to be more energy secure, simply do not understand the power of this idea. First and foremost, it is about national security. We import 60% of our oil from foreign countries. In 1970s, when the energy crisis first arose, we were only importing 30%. 60% of our oil is imported. 60% of the resources that we spend for energy, our hard-earned dollars, are traveling somewhere overseas, probably to countries we don't necessarily agree with or don't necessarily like us. And it makes far more sense to me to continue providing opportunities for investment here in the United States, because we know we also know that when you expand opportunity, when you get to the 36 billion gallon threshold that Congress has set for biofuels, roughly a quarter of our fuel supply, we know that there will be 1 million additional jobs in rural America. We know that there will be $100 billion of capital investment in rural America at a time that it desperately needs that opportunity. There is something to be said about what's happening in rural America and for the country to pay attention to it. Historically, rural America in the last number of years has been a place with high poverty rates and high unemployment rates. It's interesting to me that in this most current recession and difficult times, the unemployment rate is inching down more quickly in rural America than any other place. Now, why is that? It's because I think the farmers in this room have provided the prescription that this nation must follow to get itself back totally on its feet. Think about this. It's three basic functions. Number one, farmers understood by going through difficult times in the 70s and 80s that they can't be overburdened with debt. And so today, for every dollar of farm debt, there are $11 of assets. Farmers put themselves in a position to withstand difficult times by being very careful about debt. And now we have the rest of the country understanding that message, that we've got to get our fiscal house in order, and we have to restore some sense of balance. Farmers understood that. Number two, farmers understood the need for embracing innovation and new technology so that they could become more productive. Nobody in this country, nobody in this economy, I'd venture to say, has been as productive over the long haul as American agriculture. My lifetime, a 330% increase in corn production, over 200% increase in corn, in soybeans and wheat production. Why is that? Because American farmers embrace technology. And because of that, American farmers now have enough to be able to meet the food needs and the feed needs and the fuel needs and the export needs of the rest of the world. So the message is quite simple from farm country. We need to have a government that spends less but spends it wisely. We need an economy that makes, creates, and innovates, and we need a nation that exports. And when we do that, we see the kind of income projections that we're speaking of today in farm country all across the country. We see job growth. We see emerging middle classes and strengthened middle classes and expanding middle classes. You all have set the table for the rest of the country. All we need to do now is follow. My time is up, but I'm going to take a few more minutes. because I want to address a couple of issues. I want to address the food versus fuel issue. It is irritating to me that we have to read about this all the time, because what this basically is saying is that the folks advancing this argument do not understand or do not accept the notion that our farmers are as productive and smart and innovative and creative enough to be able to meet the needs of food and fuel and feed and export. And secondly, it tells me that folks don't fully appreciate the extraordinary productivity gains that have recently been made and the fact that there is still opportunities for us to be even more productive in the future. I say to those who raise this argument, do not bet against the American farmer. You should never, ever bet against the American farmer, because if you do, it is a losing bet. Then there is this notion that somehow the folks in this room are responsible for food increases. You've read that one, haven't you? Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I'll make a deal with the rest of the country. I will accept responsibility for food increases, food price increases, if you give me more of the food dollar. Farmers only get 20 cents of every food dollar. And you could double the cost of some of these commodities and you wouldn't see all that much increase in food. You know, I think OPEC's got more to do with food increases than farmers. And that gets me back to the first point, that if we produce more of our own fuel, we wouldn't need OPEC and we wouldn't have this problem. Now, very quickly, because I know my time is up, recognize that despite the fact that times are good, there's always certain circumstances, certain folks in certain parts of the country that get through difficult and tough times, not through no fault of their own. That's why over 200,000 producers last year received disaster assistance. That's why we're trying to figure out how to streamline the processes for disaster assistance, how we're looking as we create opportunities for the next farm bill, how can we work these disaster programs more effectively and make sure that we make sure that all the commodities are fairly treated. I know I'm in a state that went through its fair share of difficult weather conditions this year. I just signed a letter to Governor Scott declaring a number of counties here in Florida as disaster areas so that those folks would be available for disaster assistance. We know that we have to continue looking at risk management tools. I'm proud of the fact that we've expanded crop insurance to over 14,000 new farmers because of the expansion of the farm program and the crop insurance program to a number of commodities, to biofuel feedstocks. We're looking at that. We're also looking at range and pasture land. And I agree with Chairman Lucas that we're going to have a very interesting conversation about the farm bill, for no other reason that we do have to get serious about the deficit. But I would say a couple things about the deficit. Number one, there clearly needs to be shared sacrifice. Shared sacrifice. That means everybody has got to share. And I like to point out to my friends that we stepped up first. We took a look at our crop insurance program. We redesigned it. We were able to save $4 billion and put that towards deficit reduction. Farmers and ranchers ought to get some credit for moving out first. And it's not just shared sacrifice, it's also shared opportunity. The reality is that you can try to cut this budget as much as you can, but the key to getting us in a much more better sustainable position relative to debts and deficits is not just to simply reduce spending, but it's also to grow the economy. And you got to make sure that you make proper investments in research and development. You got to make sure that there's an adequate safety net so that there is an opportunity to grow, so that we can grow our way out of this deficit in addition to cutting our way out of this deficit. And let me just end, as I almost always do, and as I think I did with this group last year, pointing out why this is all so important. It's something I said directly to the President not long ago. And that is, Mr. President, it isn't just what these folks do for us in terms of feeding our families, as important as that is. It isn't just that these folks are the stewards of 80% of the landmass of the United States in one form or another, and that they cherish and care deeply about that landscape and understand the responsibility of passing it on to the next generation. It isn't about the fact that the people in this room and thousands like you are responsible for a substantial amount of the water that we consume in this country. It isn't that you create one out of every 12 jobs. It isn't that you create trade surpluses. It's also that you are where the core values of this country are rooted. And it is reflected in the fact that your sons and daughters not only want to follow in your footsteps on the farm, but also understand and appreciate the responsibility that they have to their country, which is why you represent but 16% of the country's population, but 44% of the folks who serve in military come from your homes. And there is a fundamental reason why that is important to know. It isn't to assume that folks are going into the military so that they have another opportunity. It's because as you raise your children, as you teach them about the farming operation or the ranching operation, as you talk to them about the seasons and you talk about the cycles of nature, you explain to them that there's a responsibility that every landowner has, every farmer has, to give something back to that land so that it can continue to give to us. And you ingrain in your children that value system, and then you simply make a point that a country is no different. You can't keep taking from the country. You instill in your youngsters an understanding and a responsibility to give something back, and it's reflected in their service. That's why it's important to have a farm bill. That's why it's important to understand the work that farmers and ranchers do, because you're the heart and soul of this country. Thank you very much.
No, you're perfect. Thanks so much for being here. Thank you. Thank you much. Thank you.